That's your another episode.
Tuned in to WPVMLP Asheville 103.7 on your FM radio and streaming at WPVMFM.org.
From Feature Story News in the UK, I'm John Beaver. US President Donald Trump says he's prepared to play a waiting game and use economic pressure to resolve the conflict with Iran. It comes as the Iranian Foreign Ministry said that the Strait of Hormuz will remain closed until the US met certain key demands, including the lifting of a naval blockade. Meanwhile, President Trump is under further pressure after Israel formally rejected the 15-point Gaza peace plan drawn up by his Board of Peace. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has declared that Israeli forces will not withdraw from Gaza until Hamas is fully disarmed. The rejection comes with Netanyahu facing an election on the 27th of October, with polls suggesting his coalition could lose its majority. Oliver McTernan is a former mediator and director of Forward Thinking, a London-based organisation that works to resolve conflicts in the Middle East.
I think Netanyahu's response was totally predictable. It is a question now whether he will be prime minister or not after October. I think had he agreed to the proposal.
Was hit in a recent Russian strike in Ukraine. William Denslow reports.
The Ukrainian drone strike occurred roughly 750 miles east of its border, targeting a city that's one of Russia's oil refining hubs. Russian officials say industrial and civilian facilities were targeted. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says one of its warehouses in the Ukrainian city of Dnipro has been hit twice by Russian strikes in the space of 24 hours. The WHO chief says the facility contained emergency health supplies and called for attacks on healthcare sites to stop.
The strongest tropical cyclone to hit China this year, Typhoon Dolphin, made landfall on the country's east coast. It brought massive evacuations of vulnerable areas, heavy rain and strong winds, as Laura Westbrook reports.
Typhoon Dolphin made landfall in eastern China on Sunday night, packing winds of around 150 kilometers per hour. A huge mobilization effort took place in China ahead of the storm's arrival to move hundreds of thousands of people from high-risk areas to safety. Ships were also ordered back to harbor and hundreds of flights cancelled, including at Shanghai's two main airports. The typhoon has been downgraded as it moves north, but it's still expected to bring with it a lot of rain, and that brings with it the risk of flooding and landslides, so authorities remain on alert.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks, looking today in more detail at the bombshell claim by Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent that the Strait of Hormuz is not going to return to anything like normal anytime soon. It came in a local TV interview, the Treasury Secretary suddenly becoming the first top Trump official publicly to abandon the pretense that the free flow of traffic through the strait, brought to a standstill by President Trump's war on Iran, will eventually return. The interviewer, Mark Curtis of News 12 in Arizona.
Some have speculated the strait will never go back to being the way it was before. What would you say?
I think they're saying that in a doomsday sort of way. I would say it in another way. The strait is never going back to the way it was because the Iranians tried to use it as a choke point. What we are going to see over the next 2 years, the strait's going to become irrelevant. It is going to become just another body of water. And I would say that more than 50 or 70% of the energy that moves through the strait now is going to go through underground pipelines.
For weeks leading up to that interview, Mr. Bessent had insisted that negotiations with Iran were going to bear fruit, the strait would reopen, and the price of oil would sink like a stone. Now he's warning the markets and the rest of the world that for at least the next 24 months, we'll all be paying through the nose for energy. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
To recap the top stories. US President Donald Trump says he's prepared to play a waiting game and use economic pressure to resolve the conflict with Iran. Russian officials say Ukrainian drone strikes killed at least 12 people and injured 39 others, but it comes as the World Health Organization says one of its warehouses was hit in a recent Russian strike. And the strongest tropical cyclone to hit China this year, Typhoon Dolphin, has made landfall on the country's east coast. That's the latest feature story news. John Beaver reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Expect warm and humid weather over the next several days, with a mix of sunshine and clouds and highs in the upper 80s. A few scattered showers and storms will be possible from time to time, mainly during the afternoon and evening, with rain chances increasing a little toward the weekend. Most days will still have plenty of dry time. Nights will stay mild, with lows in the upper 60s. I'm Rebecca Lane on Radio Asheville, 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country, sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPBM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent, commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant and behavioral health expert. With me today is Dr. Ingrid Bovida. Dr. Bovida received her master's and doctoral degrees from the University of Utah and specializes in assessment and diagnoses in clinically complex cases, particularly those involving neurodevelopmental differences. She is the founding psychologist at The Hive Psychological Services, a premier and neurodivergent-informed psychological testing practice, as well as the co-founder of Cogenuity, which provides QEEG and neurofeedback services nationally. Dr. B, as she is often called, identifies as neurodivergent, and much of her work is rooted in helping clients and their families better understand their unique profile of strengths and struggles, understanding that some of these struggles need to be contextualized in societal norms of normality. Dr. B personally understands what it feels like when all the pieces do not connect. Despite trying one's best, she is intent on shifting society's paradigm of how we help neurodivergent individuals, and is passionate about working with families and educating providers, educators, and support persons toward these efforts. Dr. B, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
The thing I was going to ask you about, in working with people on the spectrum, because you and I both presented at the last autism symposium conference, not symposium, but the autism research symposium. There's a difference between those. And one of the things that I talked about in mind that you hit on, and I saw hit on in a few different places, was that how, you know, mental health treatment's really failing people on the spectrum a lot, because we, you know, a lot of people have been treating them the same way, you know, and they've got symptomology that's like that. They've got, you know, they've got symptoms that look like OCD, or they are OCD. They've got symptoms that look like personality disorder, which are kind of misdiagnosed, actually. They might even have symptoms that people think are thought disorder, but they're not. They're just very deeply rooted in kind of their process and their rigidity and those kinds of things. And then they try treating them in these kind in what I refer to at times as pressure cookers. You know, they're clinical pressure cookers. It's like group all day and, you know, individual therapy twice a week and all this other stuff. And it's too much for them. A lot of them, it's really too much. And for others, like, they can track the content and they can teach DBT skills, but they can't use them at all. When on the assessment end, how are you dealing with that? Like, how are you putting a grip on that in terms of not only understanding this person's clinical assessment, but also like bringing it to families in a way that they can understand, and bringing it to whoever consultant they may be involved with so that they place accurately and put them in a program that can give them the right resources? What is it? How does it look from your end, the assessment end, dealing with that?
Yeah. So, I literally just finished a meeting with consulting group and parent where we were discussing exactly this. So we have a few different things in it, but at the end of the day, someone's test scores actually are kind of the lesser thing we talk about, or the thing that is kind of, we'll discuss it at a 30,000 foot level, unless there's something clearly significant about, for example, someone's cognitive profile. That's usually what I end up not spending a considerable amount of time discussing when I do a review of findings. I want the family treatment team, consultants, and depending on the client, the client themselves to understand why. Because, and this kind of goes to the point that you were making, that we tend to, we do a great job identifying what the behaviors are, right? They're being defiant to requests, or they're refusing this, or they push people away, then pull them back in, or their mood is labile and kind of all over the place. And we can think, as I mentioned these, we can think bipolar, BPD, right? Like all these different oppositional defiant disorder. Like we can think about all these diagnostic
PDA,
labels,
right?
PDA, right. And then as soon as we, you know, in our minds even kind of assign that label, when we think about that person, we immediately look at them from the lens of that diagnostic profile. What we tend to not look at, and this is where the why comes in, is, you know, nervous system wise, what is going on? Medication interaction wise, what is going on? I mean, we are seeing research, just as a minor example, that says that someone who is autistic, the way that medications interact with their brain is different. And that makes sense to me, because the story tends to be they've been on all these meds, none of them seem to really work right. And they tend to create side effects or cause secondary problems. So immediately I'm like, yep, that tracks, right? We are seeing behaviors and we're not thinking about why. So just, you know, and this was part of what I had discussed today. When someone refuses something, is it, you know, we can assume, oh, it's because they are lazy, or they want to test boundaries, or they want to assert control, or whatever. We're not thinking, well, perhaps there's something about the request that has completely overwhelmed their nervous system to the point that, it's not that they want to be defiant. It's that they cannot. There's something about the request that is overwhelming to them. Case in point, I worked with an adolescent female a couple of years ago that was in treatment. All she wanted was friends, all the things. She's on the autism spectrum. And there was somebody sitting next to her that was talking very loudly. She had her headphones on and she could still hear them. She took her headphones off and said, could you shut the fuck up? And she, great self-advocacy, right? Number
didn't
one.
Miss a beat.
Yep, didn't miss a beat. The kid did shut up, but she got in trouble. And when the therapist was processing things with the family and with me, because of course I did the testing, and it's like, help us understand why she would do this if she wants friends. The therapist said, well, you know, she is pushing people away and she is doing this because she wants to, you know, she had this whole thought out conceptualization for why this client had told this peer to shut the fuck up, and implemented consequences and decisions for that student in line with that conceptualization, which was rather punitive. So my question was, is this what the client said they were trying to do? Push someone away, be mean, whatever the conceptualization was. And then she said, well, no, but this person has a history of X, Y, and Z. And I said, no, did you ask? And the answer was again, no. So I said, well, why don't we ask this client what their intent was, what they were trying to accomplish, right? So the, you know, we asked the client, she's 15 years old, and she said, I just wanted her to stop talking so loudly. Now, of course it didn't come out right, you know, and so there is some coaching around intent and impact kind of matching up. But the intent wasn't to hurt or to be mean or anything, nefarious. It was just, I'm trying to listen to my music and calm down. And there's this really loud talking and I just wanted her to stop. The way we work with that, the why, right, therefore is very, very different. And I just see that clinicians, we do this where we make these assumptions instead of asking what sounds like a stupid question, right? Because, you know, the reason is obvious. No, it's not always obvious. Why? What was the intent? And so that's what I try and get people to understand is what the why of the behavior, and how do we work with that, as well as like some of that nervous system stuff.
Clinicians, they have a bit of a problem sometimes, I think, with Occam's razor. You know, the whole like simplest explanation is probably the right one. Why did you do this? Because I wanted him to be quiet.
Because I wanted him to be quiet, right? And we're overcomplicating it. Like, this is part of the attachment, or this is part of the, you know, whatever. And it's like, no, she just wanted them to be quiet. So getting everyone to understand that.
Well, I think that, you know, and to a certain extent, you know, a clinician's value is around their ability to assess things that they're not necessarily told or not necessarily obvious.
Sure. Yeah.
But, you know, it's like if you're always using that as a mechanism, you know, that you're making determinations and putting behaviors in boxes and explaining them or deducing what they mean and so on without asking, it becomes a practice. And I think this is where, you know, individuals on the spectrum have gotten a bit of a raw deal in treatment is that they, you know, we've assigned a lot of values and some clinical assumptions around what explains certain behaviors. And you know, that might apply. You know, as a person who's a diagnostician, and all clinicians are supposed to be that to a degree, you know, you go back to the boxes. It's like, well, a person with these behaviors, you know, this one, it fit inside this box. That's got this label and it means these things. And so I'm using a diagnostic profile mechanism that causes me to understand the root cause of some of these behaviors so that we can diagnose and treat, except for the fact that none of it fits the person that you're dealing with. And then you forget to ask. You forget to ask, why did you say that? Oh, because I wanted to be quiet. It's like, well, you know, let's do some coaching about ways you could ask for that differently. I'm not saying that that's not a need or an invalid need of yours, but let's come up with some ways. And then all of a sudden, you're not treating a malady. You're just coaching some language. You know, it's like, one, it's far easier to do what we're talking about than it is to do all this other, these machinations around what is it, a treatment profile and you know, a plan, a treatment plan that's going to exercise around this particular condition, all of which is erroneous because no one asked, or just be like, let's use some different words. And I think you get a better response from people.
Right. Let's match the intent with the impact a little bit. And I feel you know, diagnostic labels are helpful because, to your point, right? Sure. Like, you can then say, okay, here's the profile of a person, but it also, I think, collapses people into overly simplistic ways of looking at them. So if I told you, you know, so-and-so is autistic, you don't know really what that means because, you know, the spectrum is so broad, right? And it really is about understanding that person's profile of strengths and struggles. Versus we might go in and say, okay, autistic. So here's my understanding of their struggles around relationships, their sensory profile, their engagement with their interests. And none of those things might be relevant for that person. You might take ADHD and say that person can't pay attention. And I'm often educating people and saying ADHD is not a disorder of inattention. It's a difference in how the brain regulates attention and allocates its cognitive resources. And when you put it that way, it opens the door to discussing why they're so tired or why sleep is disrupted or why sometimes they don't pick up on social cues because they've got their own thing that they're focused on. You know, it explains so many more things than you're inattentive. So it's kind of like I heard at one point, right? Like, I think about diagnostic labels a little bit like stereotypes. And there was an awesome TED talk many years ago that I saw that said, you know, the problem with a stereotype is not that it's untrue, it's that it's incomplete. And so that's how I approach a diagnostic label. It's a good start. But if I told you this person has autism or this person has ADHD, there's a benefit to like, okay, I kind of have like a, you know, script for what that means. The drawback is you run the risk of making that thing that may not even be that thorough, their whole, the everything about them, their whole story.
Their identity. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and I'm working with someone right now, and he said something I thought was really interesting. You know, an individual on the spectrum, an adult who's been kind of dealing with this, and older. And he said part of the issue that he deals with is that whenever somebody is interfacing with somebody, he doesn't have anything to rely on. You know, if you walk out in the world, and you pick up on social cues, and you're a person who doesn't struggle with these things, and you can, you know, walk in and start up a conversation and, you know, and talk about some general things and walk out and everything else. We have some shared content that we can rely on. Yeah. We have some shared understanding around the way the world works. We have some shared ability to pick up on social cues. We have some, you know, or even verbal cues. It's like, you know, this is the beginning of the conversation, and this is the part where we talk about stuff that's not really all that important. This is the part where we say goodbye because this conversation is over. That kind of stuff. A lot of stuff that many people will take for granted. And he said, you know, the thing is that every time I begin interfacing with somebody like this, I start from scratch every time. I have to build a framework for understanding every person and every scenario that I deal with. And it's exhausting.
And that's like, a lot of data.
That's brilliant. I know, right? Like if all of a sudden it's like you walked into a different country, all of a sudden you didn't speak the language, you didn't know any of the customs and you know all that other stuff. And every day you woke up in a different country and you had to figure it out all again. It's like, that would be exhausting. And that's how they feel when they walk through life. And then you put them into treatment where this is their experience of the world. And what they're doing is walking into a group and talking to people all day long. It's no wonder they get fried from that experience. They don't want to do it anymore. They refuse to go to group. Oh, they're not engaging in treatment. It's like, no, you've overwhelmed them and they can't not benefiting from anything that's here. They don't feel better. And more importantly, they don't feel safer. And I think that was another theme that we hit upon. It's like a lot of what a person on the spectrum is dealing with is safety.
Yeah.
Their nervous system is on hypervigilance all the time because they can't pick up the cues. They're not sure what to expect. Suddenly they're being judged, or they've done something wrong, or they said something and everybody, you know, they have this kind of trauma, you know, repeatedly traumatizing experience every time they interface with the world. And they just don't feel safe. So if I can get you to a place where you feel safe, then we might be able to do something that looks like training and coaching and being able to interface with the world. How does that show up in an assessment in your view? Like when you see somebody, like where does it show up in the places where you're looking closely?
Well, there, you know, and this kind of goes with what you were saying. When I think of an autistic person and I think of safety, I think about predictability. And when you don't have predictability, right, you don't have trust. Now that we can argue, right? Oh, well, that's the case with non-autistic people. And sure, right? We all were there for the pandemic. We suddenly our predictability and, you know, the world and people dying and, you know, all of these things were awry.
Can I go somewhere? Right. Can we fly yet? Can we go home? Should we go stay home? I don't know what we need to do.
Right. Yeah. When will this end? I don't know. And so, you know, I think about that because our sense of prediction, our predictive systems were no longer functional for us. They no longer were something that we can rely on. And so this goes with what you're saying with that person you were talking about, that, you know, if you don't have that script where you have to start over every time with everyone, you don't have predictability. You don't have something that you can say, well, this is how I expect this interaction to go. So you can't, you know, you then are approaching every situation with a fundamental lack of safety. And in an assessment room, it's very much the same thing. I recognize that I am a complete stranger. Some people don't have a script for, you know, testing. Some have had testing before, and that's great. And oftentimes their experience of testing was, at best, it was really boring. At worst, I don't want to say traumatic, but unpleasant. For whatever reason, right? And so I care about doing it differently. I think that there are ways of getting information that don't involve constantly grilling somebody or just the way that they're engaged with testing just for long, long periods of time. And all they want to do is find a connection point. And I used to do this where I would meet with somebody, I knew what, you know, some of their interests were, and they would bring something up and I would essentially be like, oh, that's great. And let's move on back to testing. And then when I realized, like, this is how this person is trying to connect with me, which they totally don't have to do. They could just be like, this is a, you know, I don't like this. When I realized that this is a way that is structured and predictable and more comfortable, a more comfortable way for them to connect with me, it really changed the way that I do assessment. Because that for me is crucial, not just for the quality of the data that you get, but you actually get so much more in outside of the questions you ask or the test items you administer. It's like, I let parents talk on and on and on, not because I'm like, oh, I don't care, you know, I'm just going to let their mouth run. It's because I actually get so much more valuable information outside of my structured questions from parents. And it's the same with clients. But, you know, I try and create as much predictability as possible. Here is what you can expect. Here's what's expected of you. But also that there are going to be some things that I'm not going to be able to explain why I gave this or what the correct answer is or whatever. And there's a reason for it. So if I tell you, oh, I can't tell you that, right? Now you understand why.
Yeah, I think that for, you know, and as consultants, we look for assessment folks and, you know, as evidenced by you being on the show, it's like we look for people who can, they can provide us with something that is greater than the sum of its clinical data.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and people will do this, and you see parents do it all the time. They'll dig into the scores and they'll try to understand what the scores are and try to put something together that looks like their own understanding of what this is. A person who can do a good assessment can do exactly what you're talking about, which is find different ways to information that's going to be really valuable to feed into what this assessment is and can speak to it. It's like, yeah. I don't have a measure for this, but let me point out something that I thought was really, really, you know, important in the time that we spent together. And,
yeah.
And, you know, these features came out or these responses came out of this person. And it occurred to me that, you know, that this was important or they didn't feel safe with this or whatever it was. And that's right. Going to be really critical wherever they go get care. Because those people are going to have to pick up on the same thing, figure out a way to like honor it with this person and give them, help them feel safe and move forward. Because if they don't have this, they're going to put up the same barriers and they're going to not benefit from anything that's there. And you're going to come away with diminished results, if any results at all. Sometimes it's worse when they come out, right?
Yeah. And I see with like, and I'm sure you've seen this too, like, when a clinician makes a treatment plan, they include like, many, many goals. And all of these goals are important, right? Like we could argue that I don't disagree with these goals.
So many goals.
So many goals, right? But that's another point of overwhelm. I just finished working with a young adult in a transition program that, to his credit, incredibly motivated, wants to figure himself out, wants to get better. But, you know, he had these five goals and each of them have these sub goals that he himself made. So his therapist was like, this is great. you know, like, thank you for giving me these goals. And now I'll write them in clinical jargon and we'll satisfy that requirement. And it's like, you know, and the talk that this client and I had was, this is all great. Absolutely. But you've got to focus on one, maybe two of these while you're here. Because otherwise, like, you're learning something new, you're trying to do something different. And it's like people, the what I sort of compare that to is like January 1, people join the gym, they completely overhaul their diet, 180 degrees, they start taking the supplements, they start setting their timer to go to bed early and wake up early. Like, they're making too many changes that risk it not being sustainable. And so you can't focus on all of those different things. Pick one, maybe two. And start there and get that going.
Try not to look too far down the road. Like, you know, like, be here now, man. You know what I mean? Like, where are we at? Let's be where we're at. And it's obviously we're trying to get somewhere else, but I think one of the mistakes that you see, that lots of people make, not just, you know, not just professionals in this field, but frankly, in any field, and people make for themselves, is they put, you know, the goals, as you say, but they've put this image of themselves, or potentially the image of someone else that they're working with, in a box. Here's this box of the person that I see that is successful, having completed all of these goals. And then you get attached to it. And then when it starts to not go at the pace you want it to go, or diverts, you kind of get hung up about, like, oh, we got to do something else, and we got to move a little faster. And then the person's work centers around them being impatient with how slow they're going towards this mark that they've established, this benchmark or this box this person's supposed to fit in when they get to the end of it, instead of just being with the person. And this happened to me early on in my time in the field. And I had somebody, he was an older adult, you know, a lot of medications, he was very social, liked people. It's like, well, you could do things like be a Walmart greeter. You could do, you know, volunteer down at the such and such or whatever. He's like, I really just want to be. And this person was, you know, 50 plus at the time. I really just want to be, you know, in a nursing home. Because in a nursing home, they did activities. They had they had medical. They had a nurse that he could see all the time because he spent a lot of time trying to go to the hospital. Something else was wrong with him. He was one of those guys.
Yeah.
And they also had lots of people. So there were people around that wanted to have conversation with people that didn't have a lot of people filling their lives. He knew it was an environment that he would probably thrive in. But everybody kept going, no, you know, you could live independently and you can have these goals and you can do these things. Yeah. And we beat our heads against a wall for a year trying to have him fit inside of this mold we had created. And finally, we were like, okay, nothing we're doing is going to do it. Maybe he's right. He just needs to go to an assisted living. He went to assisted living. He was happy as a peach.
Yeah.
He did actually end up going and doing some things that were different than what he would ordinarily do. But he had the base established. He knew what he needed. And we just didn't listen. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It was a huge lesson for me in general.
Yeah. Well, because we always think that we're the ones with training. We know better than our clients. And I'm guilty of that sometimes as well. And sometimes it's like a lack of trust in that particular person, right? What if what you want is not what you need? Or what if, you know, and we see this a lot with adolescents where it's like, I just want to be home and, you know, do all the things and leave me alone. And in those cases, you're like, no, like, I need you to trust that I do know better about what you need.
Something else. Right.
You need something other than being a basement baby. And so, you know, but there are
clients.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the consensus is, you know, clear here. But there are clients where it's like, you know, they know what will make them happy. So it's a balance, right? Where we're not assuming we know better every, you know, in every way, every time with everyone. So
we're not saying they don't need help co-creating whatever that is.
Right.
It's just, exactly. That, you know, there's this saying, and NAMI has, it's nothing about us without us. It's like, you know, it, like they need to be a part of this process so that they can help guide the thing because it's coming from them, you know. So
yeah.
They need professional help. We're not arguing that, but some of that professional help needs to also know how to listen and, you know, take different information in and everything else. I think that we're looking at a transformation of the field, you know,
yeah.
A lot more information. And I hope that that's going to translate to a different way that, that clinicians get trained as well. But, you know, probably slow, but, you know, when they get out of the world of the, you know, wilderness and private pay and those kinds of things, they kind of see a different model. And I think that that's probably where it all begins. But, Ingrid, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be here.
Dr. Ingrid Rovida joining us on Head Inside Mental Health Today. Todd Weatherly, your host. Look forward to seeing you folks next time. Take care.
Oh, caritas, nobis tempestas. storm lament. Nu consigli tu e mali ogni inscrimen. Triste tante lacrime tra viste stolo te terra quei maribus magnus et clau. O caritas, o caritas,
give me time forever, here in my time.